revolution is the plan that comes out. Since the left of the party passes, it's conservative to push the change, it's unlikely to last in the future. Conservatives aren't reacting to it. If you're conservative, they would or should try to put the entire sector in the bottom. Women suffering, birth control, civil rights, these are not concrete passive liberal orders. That's a good thing. Homosexuality is a question, and therefore a tough issue for conservative parents. But at least in the negative, there are a few conservatives who want to be clear about homosexuality. Homosexuality, yes, is that the name of the left side, for example, so that may well be the best. Indeed, for a man, the marriage is in some respect, but this is not happening. In the 1980s and 1990s, they have added. In the radicals of the early 21st century, who ostensibly practiced objectives, the iron cage of bourgeois method, a relevant question for conservatives hinges on sincerity, which is impossible to gauge because they have internalized an incremental method of torture. While gay marriage and attempted men homosexuality conservative, which is conservatizing institutions, or is it merely a trophy in your campaign for exemption? In the 1990s, queer theorists declared war on marriage as an oppressive force. The ACLU has already taken a legal civil rights issue. Robin Tippett Moore wrote a book arguing that families should be viewed as any group as they also love each other. These are responsibilities bound by passion. Conservatives are hardly the strength of many of them. They say that it's not marriage, and green passion. The idea of a long time will start to lose many of the national social and environmental. As many have observed, part of the environmental idea is also used as dark and solely in addition to the sickness of Western civilization. Man has lost his harmony in which his family and his way of life is now corrupt, unnatural. Perhaps the most prominent component of the tradition is the ethical side of arguably the most popular liberal in America. As he writes in his clearly the retreat from the rules, ideology, and civilization not only breaks new problems, as we become increasingly isolated to one another and disconnected from our roots. We are relentless in sanctity, arguing cut off from our authentic selves. Broad and frenzy of industrial civilization mask our deep loneliness.
Well, good afternoon, girls and boys, ladies and gentlemen. I am Wayne Elliott, a.k.a. Web Madman, here for another week of Art Space Noise Space. We're a little late off the mark, but, you know, it's a Saturday. What can you say? Pilot K9 is here with me. A.K.A. Brian Wagner.
I went to the Steve Daniels show, and how come you didn't?
I was otherwise engaged. I've been, yeah, up to my ears in it.
It was a good opening.
Good, good. What was your take or impression on homologies?
It would take a while to figure them all out.
Uh-huh.
There are a bunch of little machines that react to your presence.
Oh, yeah.
But they all have different behaviors. Some of them have a short attention span, some are a bit shy.
Huh. Jeez, that sounds like actual humans. Are we going to have a singularity emerging from art space throughout this show? Or?
Eventually, yeah. Uh-oh. Yeah, one of them kept opening and closing while I was taking a picture of another one.
Oh, yeah.
Wait a minute.
It was reacting to you.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's cool. And you say that the opening was good?
It was a good time, yeah.
Cool, cool. Well, there was a lot of people come out? Or?
Yeah.
Good, good. Did the artist give a talk at all? Or?
He did, and it was documented.
Oh, good.
And I guess it's not on the website yet.
No, but I'm glad to hear that they documented it, because I wasn't there and I missed it, and I would have liked to have heard what he had to say. I'm I'm sure that I'll be, you know, down there through the course of the actual show, which runs until November 15th. So,
lots of time.
Lots of time to check it all out and see what Steve has been doing.
Yeah, there's also a new show in the mudroom in the back. Ann Jaeger, Disarming Language. And this one I didn't get a close look at. I was hanging out with the electronics all night.
Oh, right, yes.
But I did take a look around, and it looked very interesting, and I'm graphically, and I want to get back to it and find out what it's all about. Right. Actually, I thought it looked cool, but I didn't spend enough time
to penetrate its deeper mysteries.
Right.
and I'm noticing that it runs until October 31st because it's a shorter run mudroom programming. So if you're out there and want to check out Ann Jaeger's Disarming Language, make sure to get down to ArtSpace before October 31st to check it out. The explanation on the website is, this work juxtaposes the charm and romance of a genre of literature and book design against its contradictory subject matter, the killing of animals, of wild animals, for profit or pleasure. By blurring the lines between written and visual language, it speaks of the unconscious influence of history and literary culture on human behavior, of nature as a metaphor for language, and confronts the contemporary dichotomy of the relationship between humans and non-domesticated animals. Interesting. Yes, I too would. I'm looking forward to going in and sort of checking out what she's put together and see what I think. Right. And then it goes into the Post-it campaign, which was quite successful in terms of...
Yep. How many of them were sent off?
I'm not sure, actually. I'd have to talk to Iga to get the full numbers. But I do know that there was, quite a few of them went out.
Yeah.
And particularly after we, quote-unquote, went national, where we had... people, you know, sort of calling in and emailing and going further than just people that were dropping directly into the art space to do it. Hopefully, some of the message will get through that, arts are actually important
to ordinary Canadians.
Yeah. Well, and on that front, I mean, there is, I think, something to be said about how artists can go about dialoguing with the general community. I think that a lot of people have a lot of preconceptions before coming into a gallery. And a lot of times when they come in and actually, kind of get past that threshold, realize that, oh, it does speak to them and it is something that they could be interested in, but there's like this barrier.
Yeah, well, you have to take a step into the gallery.
That's right.
And check it out.
Yeah. And I guess it's just, as an artist, I'm always intrigued to see how we can make that as open as possible.
Inviting.
And, appeal to people and, yeah, get them to realize that, they don't have to have a PhD in arts in order to understand art. And to enjoy it. And I think part of that is to get people to realize that their opinion is valid. If they go in and they have a certain reaction, that's a valid reaction to whatever they're reacting to. But they tend to question it and think that they're not qualified.
Yeah. A lot of people say, I don't know what it means. So
right.
It's got nothing for me.
Yeah. And that's part of, I mean, myself, I've gotten into a lot of conversations with people where I'll talk them through that process. I've done this especially with art films and stuff where
right.
I've viewed them with people where they're like, I don't understand it. And it's like, okay, but how does it make you feel? And then start getting into a dialogue with them about how they're feeling about it and to sort of unearth. Because that, I don't understand it, I think is an initial reaction that they're afraid to say how they feel about it because then they would be judged by that feeling.
Right. Well, yeah, okay. It's if they're afraid that they're not getting it right.
That's right.
Coming up with the right answer.
That's right. And I think there is the key, is the notion that there is a right or wrong. in how you perceive art. Certainly you can, over time, educate yourself and be able to get more depth and, you know, a sort of more complex perception. But I don't think anything is necessarily right. It's quite subjective.
Well, as you learn more about art, you'll learn about the various movements, about art history, about art theory.
Yep.
And that'll make your experience richer, but that applies to anything.
Exactly. And I think that comes back around to you. I think that another thing that we might want to approach is artists are ordinary Canadians. I think that on both sides there can be, you know, dividing lines put up.
I feel pretty ordinary.
Ditto. Well, though, I mean, I'm not a regular guy, but that's not necessarily by choice.
But we pick up our mail, we go to the grocery store, we do things that everyone else does.
Exactly. No. You know, I think that that, again, is you know, something that people can challenge within themselves are those assumptions of separation. And I think part of what feeds that kind of separation is the space that, not most art, but a lot of art occupies in our Western culture, especially North America, where it does actually occupy a very kind of... elite, in some ways, space in our culture, where it's, you know, most people simply absorb mass media. And in some ways, that's the only cultural input they really get.
Right.
And so they're kind of, I don't want to say brainwashed, but they're given a certain expectation. That over time they kind of take on as if it's their own expectation about what art should be. And we've talked about this before, about the lowest common denominator factor.
Right. Well, and the way that art is presented in the mass media doesn't really help.
No, exactly. And particularly where they hyper-focus on sensationalistic things, the meat dress and things of those natures.
Yeah.
Where... I think that the average person that's taking in the mainstream media is going to perceive that as indicative of contemporary visual culture, because it's the only thing they're exposed to.
Right. Or the Voice of Fire.
Right.
That giant painting that it's got... It's blue with a red stripe up it.
Right.
It's 17 feet tall.
Right.
And it cost $1.2 million.
Right. And there's another layer to all of this, is that it's part of the all or nothing kind of thing that has, you know, that is very much at the undercurrent of almost everything that we look at in culture right now, which is really annoying, where it's like you're either a successful artist making millions of dollars...
Right,
or
and then you get
nothing.
TV shows about you, and
that's right, and I think it is, you know, very much the, you know, cult of personality, the star syndrome, and all of those sorts of things. And so what ends up happening is that those people that are trying to push the boundaries and push the edges end up becoming increasingly marginalized, and these sorts of things, these outrages, you know, further marginalize, where, you know, it's the starving artist that ends up getting the brunt of the negativity because of an artist being paid $1.whatever million for painting.
Well, the artist wasn't paid that.
No.
The marketers and the owners and dealers were.
That's the other side of it. And I think that that is where this kind of elitism steps in, you know.
Well, yeah. I think the art market is a big part of the problem.
Yes, I concur. which is interesting that I find artist-run culture and contemporary visual culture a lot of times tries to challenge that very thing by not producing, you know, saleable products and, you know...
Not a commodity.
Not a commodity, looking at it more as creating... spaces and, you know, engaging in cultural dialogue in a, you know, much more kind of direct way.
Sure, yeah, you can see that with ArtSpace.
Exactly, yeah, as a our own local kind of example. Now, interestingly, ArtSpace itself has had its own history of controversy. What was the flow or river piece that was in display in the window back in the Market Hall days?
That involved menstrual blood.
Yes.
And city council, well, there were some city council members who didn't like ArtSpace at all to begin with.
Right.
Right. Uh-huh. Now, it wasn't ordinary citizens complaining that it was obscene.
Right.
Even the cops didn't think it was obscene.
Right.
But city council members used that as a justification to...
Right.
ArtSpace actually had had the Market Hall.
Yes.
For a low rent.
Yep.
And that rent was mostly paid from grants.
Right.
And a city grant in particular,
mm-hmm.
which was late every year. But then they were accused of being late in their rent.
Ah. Even though they're the actual organization that gave them the money to begin with. And
So they came and locked the doors and locked the artist out.
Wow. Oh, yeah, the war against culture, eh? but, of course, it is a typical kind of scene where it's like a very small handful of people create this huge, you know, kind of outrage and sort of rally people against something without really explaining the complexity of what's going on or without fully exploring.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
it's political.
Something else I was thinking of is how art is misrepresented in the media.
Yeah.
Is, for example, a performance festival in Toronto years ago that I was involved in.
Yeah.
There was a short clip on the news, and they had purposely picked the weirdest, most incomprehensible performance to show a clip.
Right.
And then they said, this cost us $5,000.
Right.
Well, no, that
particular piece might have cost, you know,
$50.
Right. And was part of a much larger sort of thing, exactly.
Sure,
you know. But
that's, it's not just typical, it's consistent.
Yeah, yeah. Well, because through this, latest kind of fiasco with the cuts and going online and into the forums and stuff, I'll come across a lot of people that will make statements about how... art should pay for itself. That there's this notion that if it's not producing a saleable product that can, you know, sustain it in that sort of, you know, hardcore capitalist kind of sense, then it shouldn't exist. That, you know, there's this kind of like neo-Darwinianism around economics this way, right?
That's also looking at economics as being the only important factor.
That's right. No. But, I mean, even given that, I think that this is where part of what our, you know, these statements and stuff that we've been trying to put out is to say that, you know, well, even on an economic factor, when you create or nurture a creative class within your community, you make money. It draws people. It makes people feel good about their region, and it draws them into, and that translates into money.
That's true. But the artists mostly work for free.
Well, and this is the other side of it, is that, and that's the key of the nurturing of the creative class, is to be able to put in the framework that can support people that are actually creating the things that are not necessarily saleable, but create an incredibly rich environment for people to live in, as a kind of
you can't put a dollar value on that.
No, and an example is something like the Folk Festival, where it's, you know, it's a free festival for people to come and you know, plug into. Now, in that case, they generate enough money to actually pay the artists. A huge amount of that money comes from grants. I mean, you know, it's you know, they do a lot of fundraising and stuff, but I think without the, you know, some of the grants
without the grants,
it wouldn't exist. you know. But the flip side of that is the economic boom that it brings to the city is great, you know.
Sure, yeah, people come from all around to see the folk festival.
That's right. And then we've already talked about ArtSpace, and I think that ArtSpace positioning itself as a respected gallery on the national scene in the visual arts, you know, sort of in that sort of arena puts Peterborough on the map. I do know that it draws some people to the area just to sort of see what's going on.
Right, and so does the studio tour.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's great because it shows people where and how the artist actually works.
Yeah. Yeah, and brings people into the creative process. Yeah, I mean, coming from Bancroft, I've helped a number of artists up there during studio tours, and it's great because, yeah, it allows people to kind of come through the studio. Sure, it's a great economic boost to the artists sometimes where, you know.
Not for me this year.
I was going to say, but I think the other side of that is the way that you're set up, unfortunately, you're sort of separate somewhat from your work.
Well, I can't bring people into my studio. It's a death trap. It's
right.
Dangerous for me to go in there sometimes.
Yeah. But you're generally on the air while you're in here.
Right.
You're not necessarily able to present your work and, you know.
Yeah, well, I had my visual art in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And a lot of people didn't want to come into the studio.
Right.
And, you know, come on in, check it out.
Yeah.
Well, no, we're going to look at the pictures.
Right.
You know, but what I do on the air
is
art, too. And it's, in some ways, it's more important than my visual art.
Well, yeah. Yeah, as you're, in terms of your creative development, that's where your main focus is. I mean, you've got two radio shows, plus you're in a noise band. That's got to say that, you know.
I think one reason why that's important is that I tend not to finish things.
Right.
There's always something more to do. It's not finished.
Right.
It's not quite right.
So you're more of a process artist than a product artist.
Right. But when I do stuff live improvised music or radio.
Yeah. It is what it is.
I have to be there and I have to do it.
Yeah.
And I can't go back and, you know, fix it if I'm not happy with it. I just have to do better next time.
Darn, where's your time machine? Go back and whisper into your ear. No, not that one.
I don't think I would do that anyway.
No. That's where I think we're from a very similar perspective in terms of being interested in what emerges from the process, rather than having a fixed notion of what the end point is going to be.
Right. Well, things change as I work on them.
Yeah.
And, you know, even things that I thought I had a pretty clear idea of what I was doing.
Right.
As I work on it, something different emerges.
Yeah. Well, and I'm thinking of a Burroughs quote where he says something about it's the random element that allows the magic in.
Yeah.
And I know myself, I really, you know, I like to, you know, there's certain things that I've developed skill at executing and sort of use those as a way of creating a foundation for things to emerge from.
Or an environment for things to emerge.
Exactly. So you're working with frameworks and processes rather than, you know, specific ideas of finished product. And I think this is something that challenges people a lot because it does fly in the face, coming back to that mainstream media notion of, you know, finished product. You know, like if you don't have, you know, a finished product with a UPC symbol on it, what do you got?
Right. Well, it's even a narrow interpretation. Sometimes, like, if someone hears that I'm an artist, right. What do you paint?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't.
I've painted houses and signs.
Right. No. Yes. Well, and that's where, I mean, myself, I've been, in terms of visual work, more and more, I've been going digital. Where there's nothing physical involved at all.
don't even have pencils anymore.
Nope. And I find that actually an awesome kind of sort of thing to play with, where, you know, it's so ephemeral. There's, you know.
It's also convenient, too.
Yeah.
You know, some of the struggles with
stuff.
Trying to store large pieces of acid-free paper.
Yep.
Illustration board.
Yep.
What happens when you move?
Yep. I actually still have lots of boxes, and I have a huge artist portfolio thing with tons of, you know, paintings, yeah. Paper.
I got a bunch of limited edition prints that I made.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to take care of them.
Yeah. No, and that's, you know, and with digital, I mean, you know, you still have, you know, hard drive crashes and CDs screwing up and, you know, so data loss.
Yeah. Yeah. I've had trouble with that recently. I got a whole bunch of scans from an anatomy book.
Uh-huh.
And they're on CDs.
Yeah.
But they're in one of those really cheap CD binders.
Oh.
That are kind of sticky inside.
Yeah.
So, I mean, pulling them out, and there's no way I'm going to use that wretched binder again.
Yep.
But even these CDs that I burned only 4 years ago,
yep.
They're corrupted.
Yep. Yeah. No, but scratches, bad idea. I mean, the flip side of that, I mean, technically, CDs, there's an example of something that was actually made to be disposable, where there are ways of fixing CDs where you resurface, particularly if there's no damage to the actual foil side. Most times, scratches are actually on the opposite to the foil and can actually be resurfaced and repaired.
Yeah.
But good luck trying to find the equipment to do that with.
I got a little canister of this. It's liquid, but it's a very, very fine abrasive to it.
Mm-hmm.
But while I was thinking of that, maybe you can use toothpaste.
Yes, there's actually, if you go online and look up fixing CDs, there's a toothpaste, peanut butter. There's been a number of different things.
Peanut butter.
Yeah. It's an oil, right?
Okay.
So,
toothpaste is, again, a fine abrasive.
Yeah. Yeah, so either you're scraping away a layer so that you get a smooth surface, or you're filling the cracks to get
with
a smooth surface
butter.
With peanut butter. but like I said, I mean, I remember when I was in college in the late 80s and they were talking about the introduction of CD media, that it was the wonder thing because it could be repaired. That, you know, they were in those early days talking about being able to stick a CD into this machine and it would just, you know, take off a layer and put another layer back on again. So it would repair the CD. And, you know, that's where it was given as an advantage over vinyl. I mean, that was one of the key advantages that sold it.
Right.
And then, oof, gone. so that everyone's, you know, scrambling with these, you know, sort of homemade makeshift kind of approaches, using toothpaste and peanut butter.
Yeah, it used to be a consumer product that you could go out and buy.
That's right. No, and I mean, but again, you know, like we are living in a consumer society, and the root of consumer is consume. And I remember I think it's Merriam-Webster that defines consume as to lay waste to.
Well, that's one definition.
Yeah.
It certainly applies.
Because I do see that it's, you know, we live in a world that's based on scarcity. And I do actually think that this relates to the this art thing as well, right? Where we want singular stars that are hard to reach, rather than pervasive creative culture that is accessible to everyone.
Yeah, a lot of people, they sort of claim that they're not creative.
Right.
And what they mean is that I think that they don't make art in the way that they think
art
is supposed to be made.
That's
right.
Mm-hmm. No, because, I mean, I know a lot of chefs that are incredibly creative.
Creative. Sure.
I also know, you know, carpenters and, you know, like any trade.
Anyone.
Yeah, can have an art to it.
Yeah, cooking is a really good example.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's something that a lot of people take creative pleasure in, and they don't think of it in those terms.
No. Well, and then that comes around to, you know, the redefining of art and creativity within our day-to-day life. Our old friend David LaRiviere was very fond of pointing out that Jackson Pollock was originally funded by the CIA.
Yeah, but was he aware of it?
No, I don't think so, actually. But it does actually indicate that... capitalism does not create an avant-garde unassisted. I think that this is, you know, one of the lessons of that is that, you know, it was something that was realized that, you know, the consumer culture will always create the lowest common denominator and will never actually aspire to create a cutting edge because it's not profitable.
Right.
Right? In that sort of mass way. So they needed to inject funds into an avant-garde in order to then get it to the level where rich people would be interested in buying, right? And
right.
So in that way...
Well, with
way,
the CIA funding, though, that's... That's a part of a propaganda war.
Yep. Yep.
Like, the art in the Soviet Union used to be the most cutting edge.
Yeah.
Because they were revolutionary.
Yeah.
They actually... painted trains in collage colors.
Right.
They were agitprop trains that would go into the country.
Yep.
They'd give speeches on communism, socialism, and they would show this revolutionary art.
Right.
And it was the whole integrated movement.
Right.
That was pre-Stalin.
That's what I was just going to say.
Yeah.
It's like
he sort of...
Yeah.
What did he do? He suppressed all of it.
Dot, dot, dot. Yeah.
And art became limited, official art.
Yeah.
It became limited to this grubby socialist realism stuff.
Yeah. Yes. Which, I mean, again, I would never condemn any kind of form of creative output. it all has a perspective to put across. The problem is that when one form becomes dominant over all others, whether that's, you know, state imposed or, you know,
economically
sort of,
imposed
or economically imposed.
Now, speaking of socialist realism
and
the propaganda value of this art.
Yeah.
I've heard advertising referred to as what happened?
Oh, I think that the screensaver just came.
The computer?
No.
Oh,
there you go.
Okay.
Okay. So we just had a black screen. Ah, the black screen.
I've heard advertising referred to as capitalist realism.
That's fair. I think that would. That's, you know.
Well, that's also parallel to I can't remember who said it originally, but. Made the claim that advertising serves the same function in a capitalist society as propaganda does.
Yeah. Oh, very much so. Very much so. I mean, if you look at television commercials, you know, for myself anyway, when I watch them, I'd not only see the selling of a product, but a selling of an ideology. In a major, major way.
It's a whole set of values.
Yeah. And there's a whole like set of underlying assumptions. Now the other side of that, and this is something that's kind of intriguing, is that advertising at this point, the quote unquote science of persuasion, runs on what do they call that when they ask people stuff? Surveys.
Right.
And you know, sort of market evaluation, and they'll do things like, oh, this the sound of this bell makes people feel this way, so we're gonna use that bell. And so it's pulling things completely out of context and using them to specifically tweak your brain.
Sure. Yeah.
And in that way, a quote that I don't know where it came from, but talking about how commercials actually mine our subconscious and launch it back at us. So there's this like bizarre feedback network going on.
I've heard that about 80% of people who graduate with degrees in psychology
go into
advertising and public relations.
That's right. And that's exactly what I'm saying, is that there's this kind of strange evolution. And, like, it's where you get the rise of things like the using rebellion to sell things, which is a complete contradiction in terms.
Right.
But yet it works. It's incredibly effective, where people will actually believe that by going out and buying this, you know, name brand running shoe, they're showing an act of rebellion.
Yeah, stick it to the man.
Yeah, bizarre.
I remember an early one that did that was Dr. Pepper.
Right.
It wasn't rebellion. It wasn't punk rock. It was.
Right.
It was just, you know, we're different.
Yeah.
We want something different.
So let's do something the same.
Well, not pretty much the same. Yeah. It's let's demonstrate it by buying this product rather than the other one.
Right. Well, and Coca-Cola, of course, is, you know, got a long history of, you know, kind of being the you know, kind of youthful, cutting edge now thing.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of dirty history to Coca-Cola.
Oh, yeah.
During World War II,
yeah.
They subsidized their sales to soldiers.
Okay.
So that American soldiers would all be drinking Coke.
Right.
And that it would be identified with freedom.
Yeah.
And democracy and the right way.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, though, they were profiting from Fanta Orange, which was specifically developed for the Nazi German market.
Right.
Well, they couldn't be selling Coca-Cola in
That's
Nazi
right.
Germany at the same time, so
That's
it's
right.
make something different.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just colored sugar water.
I know. Well, and you see, Ed, this is... like you say, it's only colored sugar water, but yet it has this huge real estate in our subconscious. You know, I mean, that Coca-Cola symbol and the red and white and the, you know, the modern Santa Claus and all of this sort of stuff. I mean,
right.
It has so much real estate in our brain. It's crazy. I mean, you know, Santa, Father Christmas, winter, you know, like there's all these different patchwork mythologies
right.
that then Nash was his name. I don't know, the painter anyway.
The designer.
Yeah, who did that huge series of red and white Santa Clauses specifically for Coca-Cola. And that actually, you know, kind of solidified the modern Christmas. You know, it was a much different
right.
celebration before, but really reinvented it as the capitalist holiday. I mean, it is an orgy of consumerism. with the, you know, red and white fat guy as the center of it all. who has very little resemblance in some ways to some of the earlier, when I was 15.
St. Nicholas.
Yeah, when I was 15, I was in Germany over Christmas and New Year's and seeing their black leather clad.
uh-huh.
Whoa.
Terminator Santa.
Oh, yeah. And who would really be quite threatening and menacing to kids that were, you know, bad, right?
Right. Well, he does keep track of who's naughty and nice.
Yeah, and he's got a whip, baby.
Uh-huh.
Not to say that we should all, you know, sort of go in that direction, but I was just saying that the legend of Santa Claus is, you know, sort of much...
He's a corporate shill.
Well, the modern version
right.
with the,
yes.
you know... red and white fat guy who surprisingly enough looks like the Amanita muscaria mushroom and well in point of fact I mean you go into the Siberian aboriginal community they would use Amanita muscaria
right.
in that time of year and on top of that one of the things that they would do is they would follow reindeer around and if they saw that reindeer were eating Amanita muscaria, they would follow that deer around and collect its pee.
Yes.
And then that's also the shaman of the tribe would drink the raw Amanita sort of liquid.
Right.
And then it would be his urine that everyone in the tribe would actually drink.
Yeah, Amanita can be recycled several times that way.
Yeah, and the first time through is when the majority of the actual toxins are removed, which is why the
shaman was a filter.
Yeah.
In more ways than one.
In more ways than one, exactly. And so the reindeer, the red and white, it all resonates, these subconscious kind of remembrances in our collective unconscious. You know, I'm showing that I'm a Jungian. But anyway.
And a drug user.
Yeah. But it does. It keys into these kind of, I mean, this goes back to a lot of Allegro. Wrote The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross,
right.
End of the Road, and he was one of the first non-Catholic scholars to have a look at the Dead Sea Scrolls. And it was from those early translations that he worked on with other people that he developed some of the theories about the formation of the Christian cult and the right. early forming of that.
Well, there have been caves found just recently that had... drawings. Uh-huh. They were inhabited by early Christians and by Gnostics.
Right.
Used them for ceremonies, and there's mm-hmm. drawings of mushrooms on the walls.
Yeah. No. And, I mean, this is also to... Allegro himself was I would class him as a fairly orthodox atheist, so didn't necessarily see any spiritual import or any larger sort of work.
He was looking more at the cultural
exactly.
significance.
Exactly, yeah. And in a fairly, not a fairly, pretty much strict materialistic kind of sense.
Right.
Whereas myself, I do see that when we alter our state of consciousness, what we experience and what we see in that state is not necessarily unreal, right? It's not necessarily...
No, it's a different way of looking
at things. It's a different way of looking at things. And so what we gather from those experiences are valid in terms of, you know, being able to add to our deeper sense of connection with our existence and, you know...
Here comes Parker.
Uh-huh. Right. Yes, I actually have... I brought a Muni Sadhu book for him to have a look at.
Which
is on the Tarot and the Kabbalah.
Before we run out of time,
yep.
Speaking of early translations mm-hmm. Early texts,
yeah.
If you follow the instructions for finding the manna from heaven,
yeah.
you find psychedelic mushrooms.
Right. Yes. Well, there's a documentary floating around online called The Pharmacratic Inquisition, which is quite fascinating.
I'll bet. Even the title.
I know, yeah. Now, there's, you know, it's a you know, one of those things where it's some people's ideas, right? And it doesn't mean that there's, you know, any absolute truth there, but they've got a lot of stuff to ponder.
Certainly.
Yeah. And so, Pharmacratic Inquisition, I would recommend you all go and pull up your search engine and have a look. It was... It's one of those movies along the lines of Zeitgeist.
Right.
Where it was very much sort of, in some ways, developed online, where the people that were making it and editing it uploaded a series of versions and got a lot of feedback in developing it. Those are the sorts of things that fascinate me right now, mm-hmm. because there's this collaborative sort of nature going on. Both of those sites have websites dedicated to proving and disproving everything in it. So you can, you know, wade into where all the perspectives are coming from. And what I like about it is that you don't need to be spoon-fed anymore. That you can actually, you know, you don't have to have access to a university in your back door in order to go to the library and look this stuff up.
Right.
You can actually, you know.
Well, of course, you can also find a lot of stuff that doesn't show up in most libraries.
That's right. That's right.
How many books on psychedelics do you find at the Peterborough Library?
Right.
Whereas, or even Trent University, for
right.
that matter.
Yeah. Whereas, go to Irowid online, and there's an insane Irowid.org.
Right.
Is probably if you are going to alter your state of consciousness, go there first.
Right.
Before you do anything, because it's got a lot of very practical, very straightforward ways of protecting yourself from doing damage.
Sure. Well, I think it should be clear to almost anyone that if you just if somebody gives you a pill at a party and says, take this, it's groovy.
Right.
You're an idiot.
Yes.
And you're putting yourself in danger.
That's right. That's right. Yes. Inform yourself. Protect yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, even Leary with the famous turn in, tune on, turn on, drop out. Yeah. He didn't recommend that anyone just go out and take acid.
No. And he actually drew from, Oswald, Humphrey Oswald.
Right.
He was drawing on Humphrey Oswald's work and basically talking about the absolute vital importance of set and setting. And set includes what you're bringing into it in terms of your mental state, your emotional state, even if you're tired or hungry. You know, like those are all things to take into consideration before you step into a very powerful experience that can shift your perspective. That's important to respect.
Fairly early on, before LSD was illegal even, Leary testified before Congress that this stuff has fantastic potential.
Right.
For teaching, for learning.
Yep.
For rehabilitation of prisoners.
Yep.
Alcoholics.
Yep.
People who are in various forms of distress.
Yep.
He said that the stuff is getting out of the lab and out of the psychoanalyst's office, and it's people are experimenting with it on their own.
Yeah.
And the responsible thing to do would be to make all this information
available.
Yes.
That's right.
They refused to do that, of course. Yeah. So Leary wrote a book called High Priest.
Yep. I read that book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had a first edition.
Yes, there was one at Dragonfly, actually. Yeah. With those amazing drawings from the guy he met in prison.
Uh-huh.